The topic today, monitoring watershed program effectiveness. There is an increasing emphasis on evaluating the results of our efforts to control non-point source pollution on a watershed basis. Evaluation must be an ongoing part of any watershed management effort based on proper design and data collection. Three types of data are needed to evaluate the watershed management projects. These include administrative, social, and environmental. Evaluation or effectiveness monitoring is designed to measure the actual impact of management decisions, such as implementation of nutrient management practices and resulting impacts of nutrient levels in the water body. Environmental monitoring needs to focus on specific variables, take place in specific locations and at a minimum frequencies to provide a measure of whether and to what extent the water quality problems are being addressed. Today's speakers will present an overview of watershed monitoring, three watershed effectiveness monitoring designs, and identify issues to be considered when developing effectiveness monitoring programs. So now, let's meet our speakers. Our first speaker, Steve Dressing, is here with us at EPA headquarters. In fact, Steve used to work with us at EPA headquarters, so we're very pleased to have him back today. Steve is now a senior scientist working with Tetra Tech. Steve has 27 years of experience in non-point source pollution and watershed scale monitoring. While at North Carolina State University, he co-authored evaluations of the Rural Clean Water Program and the Model Implementation Program, two of the nation's first watershed programs with monitoring and evaluation components. And he participated in local watershed projects across the state. Steve also worked in EPA's non-point source control program, as I mentioned, and he created the Clean Water Act Section 319 National Monitoring Program. He worked on the Coastal Zone Act reauthorization amendments called CESARA. That is the Section 6217 Management Measures Guidance for the CESARA, and he managed the Rural Sources section in the days when we had sections. Since moving to Tetra Tech, he has worked on EPA's CAFL rule and various watershed and water quality efforts across the nation and has become increasingly involved in urban runoff issues. Our second speaker, Don Meals, who is participating in this webcast from Burlington, Vermont. Don tells me that the sap is, the maple sap is flowing up in Vermont now, so I was happy to hear that. But Don is inside his house, I think. And Don is also a senior scientist from Tetra Tech. Don has 30 years of experience in non-point source pollution and watershed management. He has worked throughout the U.S. on non-point source issues, focusing on monitoring of watershed-scale response to management changes, especially in the areas of livestock, agriculture, and phosphorus. In his home state of Vermont, he designed and led several large watershed land treatment water quality monitoring programs, including projects in the Rural Clean Water Program and the Section 319 National Monitoring Program. Don has also conducted research on the water quality effects of innovative manure and livestock management and developed watershed phosphorus modeling systems to assess long-term watershed response to the implementation of phosphorus management measures. So now that I've introduced our esteemed speakers, let's get started. Steve, take it away.
Thanks, Ann, and good afternoon. I will start with assumptions that we have made in developing the material for this webcast. I'm on slide two. First off, that the project has correctly identified the water quality problems in critical areas and has developed a plan that will solve those problems. The plan, including nine key elements, is a basis. We're also assuming that those of you in the audience are familiar with basic information on monitoring variables, samples, and sample analysis methods. Having looked at the roster of attendees, I know that the level of familiarity varies, and hopefully what we present will be of some use to all of you in some way. Moving to slide three, today we will our discussion will emphasize watershed project effectiveness. We will not be discussing assessment monitoring, individual BMP effectiveness monitoring, or program delivery effectiveness. We will, though, be giving you some options that we don't want you to take as being prescriptive, but things that you can consider as you develop your own watershed monitoring effort. We will not be discussing volunteer monitoring today. We recognize that it is important in many watershed projects. The role of volunteers varies, of course, but today we will not be addressing that. Moving to slide 4, as I said, we won't be discussing today ways to monitor individual practices or BMPs. The BMPs chosen for your watershed project have, in many cases, already been evaluated individually through research or testing. That's why you selected them. The challenge now is to see if these practices and methods implemented in accordance with your watershed plan will solve the water quality problems in your watershed. Your watershed monitoring effort needs to track a signal or signals that characterize watershed conditions that you expect to change in response to the BMPs implemented to solve the problems. Your monitoring effort will need to detect meaningful but often small changes in that signal against a lot of background noise, and also be able to relate those changes to the practices and methods implemented. If your monitoring effort succeeds, then you will be able to know if and when you're achieving your watershed project goals and whether or not the practices and methods you've implemented have done the job. This, in turn, helps you determine if changes in your plan are needed to achieve your goals. The remainder of this webcast will be devoted to providing information that can help you design a monitoring program that will enable you to evaluate the success of your watershed project within a reasonable budget. Now moving to slide 5. Our discussion today will basically follow the 12 design steps laid out by Jack Clausen in a monitoring guide he developed for USDA. That guide is available in your links to additional resources. Moving on to slide 6, the first step in designing a monitoring plan is to identify the problem in the watershed, which is also key in developing the watershed plan. It's important to have a clear statement of use impairment, what type of water body you're dealing with, what are the symptoms in the water body that cause you to say there is an impairment, what are the causes of those symptoms, and then what are the sources. All of these bits of information are also important as you design your monitoring plan. The second step is to form objectives, and it's important to keep in mind that the monitoring objectives go hand in hand with the watershed management objectives. As the example shows in this slide, if your management goal is to reduce annual phosphorus loading to a lake by at least 15% in 5 years with nutrient management, then it makes sense that a monitoring objective could be to measure changes in the annual phosphorus loading to the lake and be able then to link those changes to the management actions. Moving on to slide 7. The actual monitoring design is going to depend on what you choose as your study objectives, and it's important to select this design before you begin monitoring. That sounds obvious, but that's often not the case. Some designs that Don and I would recommend against using for watershed project evaluation are the single watershed before and after design, where you have a single station at the outflow of your watershed, and you simply monitor before and after BMPs. It's difficult with that design to attribute any measured changes in water quality to the BMPs because climate, for example, could be the key factor. Another bad design, in our opinion, would be side-by-side watersheds. And I don't mean paired watersheds. We'll talk about that shortly. But using side-by-side watersheds, again, it's hard to attribute measured changes in water quality to the BMPs. It can be due exclusively to differences in the two watersheds. Now, moving on to slide 8, you see three designs that we would recommend for evaluating watershed project effectiveness: the paired, up, down, and trend designs. The trend is the cheapest of the designs. It involves one station. Paired and upstream, downstream involve two stations. It's also easy to do a trend monitoring, and one of the difficulties, however, with trend monitoring is you have to be there a long time, whereas paired and up-down monitoring may take 5 or so years to get your results. Trend monitoring, you may be there 10 to 15 years or more, and in doing that, you have to be consistent in the methods you use, and you have to avoid data gaps, and you must track everything that you tracked in the beginning of the project. So there are some disadvantages to trend monitoring as well. Paired watersheds are the most powerful design for evaluating effectiveness. You can attribute water quality changes to the BMPs and that type of study, but it's hard to find the pairs in many cases. It's also hard to control the land use and land treatment in both watersheds throughout the study. Upstream, downstream, fairly easy to do as well. One of the key issues associated with that, however, is that upstream contributions can mask the impact of the BMPs that you implement between the two stations. So that's a caution when applying the up-down design. Next slide is slide 9. A little more detail on what you do in a paired watershed study. You have two watersheds and two treatment periods. The first treatment is the calibration period, where you collect data from both watersheds and you statistically relate the data from watershed A to watershed B. Once you've done that, then you implement your controls in what's called the study watershed, and you keep the control watershed the same, and you keep monitoring, and then you look for a change in that relationship on the particular variables between the two watersheds. For more details on this design and also the upstream, downstream, and trend, I refer you to, again, Claussen's document for USDA. The statistics that you would use in upstream, downstream, typically paired t-tests. You can use non-parametric tests for trend monitoring, regression analysis, et cetera, as you see on the slide. And it's important in trend monitoring to track flow, et cetera, so that you can adjust your data for influences of hydrology. Now moving to slide 10, the next step would be to select your variables. Again, study objectives are important consideration. Also, what you've defined as the problems in the watershed. What are the pollutants of concern? It's important to consider the difficulty and cost of analysis of the variables. And Don and I would recommend that you consider using covariates. For example, if you're looking at suspended sediment in the watershed, we all know there's a relationship between that and flow. So you should monitor flow. There are other examples for covariates on the slide. Now I'll move to slide 11. And just touch upon this briefly. If you're going to monitor nitrogen, for example, there are a lot of options for the variables that you would monitor. We would recommend against doing them all. Sometimes people seem to monitor everything. But pick the variables that fit your needs. For example, organic or TKN might be something you would use for manure-impacted areas. Now moving on to slide 12, you have similar considerations with phosphorus. Again, we wouldn't recommend that you monitor all forms, but pick the form that most fits your need. Again, here, organic phosphorus might be what you would want to look at for manure-impacted areas. An additional consideration when selecting the form of nitrogen and phosphorus would be, are you using automated samplers? If you are, Don and I would recommend using Total N and Total P. The preservation and holding time are relatively simple. You can preload your bottles with sulfuric acid, and you've got a 28-day holding time. Some of the other options for N and P don't have the same simplicity in terms of preservation and holding time. Now I'll move on to slide 14. Many of you may have heard the debate over total suspended solids or suspended sediment concentration, two ways to look at sediment moving through the stream. Don and I would recommend that SSC is better for loads, and that is also USGS policy, by the way. The difference between the two approaches is in the sampling, not in the lab work. Once you get your sample to the lab, they're analyzed the same way. The difference is that with SSC, whatever your sample is, the whole thing is analyzed at the lab. With TSS, a subsample is taken, and that is analyzed. And it's that subsampling that can create an underestimate of suspended sediment by perhaps 25 to 34%. So, again, for loads, we would recommend suspended sediment concentration. Now, moving to sample type. slide number 15. Selection factors, again, what are your study objectives? Also, what are the variables that you're sampling? If you're sampling bacteria, then you need to take grab samples. If you're looking at suspended sediments, some sort of integrated sample would make sense. If your goal is to look at mass or load, you're going to find that grab samples aren't going to do the job for you. You probably need some kind of composite sampling. Now, one more slide before I turn this over to Don is slide 16. That sort of summarizes the types of samples that you can collect, advantages and disadvantages. Grab samples, for example, are simple to take. On the other hand, every time you grab, you have to have an arm using the bottle, and that means you have people. So it's pretty labor-intensive. Per sample, it's the most labor-intensive way to sample. Composite, time-weighted, and flow-weighted save you on the labor. You get more samples per labor hour, but you have to spend a lot of money on equipment. If you do time-weighted composite sampling, programming is easy. It's just every certain interval of time. For flow-weighted compositing, however, you need to know the stage-discharge relationship. And we'll talk a little more about that later, but that's a relationship that will change probably during the course of your project. So it's a little more involved than time-weighted, but it's a far better way to estimate loads. And you can see also we have some information on integrated grab sampling and continuous sampling. One of the key things with continuous sampling, for example, where you have a probe that's monitoring temperature constantly, you get a lot of data, so you need to be ready to handle all that data. Other issues associated with continuous monitoring are possibilities of fouling of the probes and also just failure of the probes. So that's it for me now, and I'll turn it over to Don Meals.
Thank you, Steve. I'm going to move on right away to slide 17. And, of course, after you've made the decisions, the kind of decisions that Steve has spoken about, you have to decide how often to collect your samples. And the appropriate sampling frequency should be based always on your monitoring objectives. And two common objectives that I want to talk about briefly are coming up with an estimate of the mean of some known precision and the detection of change, which is something we're often interested in watershed projects. So going to slide 18, I want to show you a simple procedure for coming up with the number of samples necessary to obtain an estimate of a mean for water quality variables such as phosphorus concentration with a certain amount of statistical confidence. And the equation in slide 18 is very simple. It calculates N, the calculated sample size, using value of students T statistic from a table, an estimate of the population standard deviation symbolized as S, and D is the acceptable difference between the estimate and the true mean. And I'm going to show you an example moving to slide 19, which assumes that you know something about your system. You know the mean and the standard deviation, for example, from some previous monitoring, perhaps by another agency. And you can see the examples of the mean for total phosphorus of 0.89 milligrams per liter, etc. And we're going to evaluate how many samples you would need to come up with a difference between your estimate and the true mean of 10 and 20%. So moving, using the equation that I showed you and these data in slide 19, moving to slide 20, you can see that 73 samples a year are required to come up with an estimate of the mean total P concentration that's within 20% of a true mean. Whereas to be within 10% of the true mean, you'd need almost four times as many samples, 281 samples. And I should point out that for those of you who might want to try this exercise on pencil and paper afterwards, this can be an iterative process. You run through with your first estimate, and you may come up with a very different number of samples, and you have to recalculate using a different T statistic. So that's how you actually apply this. Moving to slide 21, you can also use this formula to work backwards to evaluate a sampling frequency that's proposed for a particular monitoring program. And in this example, using the same basic statistics as in the previous couple of slides, you can see that monthly sampling, 12 samples in a year, would put you within about 54% of the true mean, plus or minus. However, quarterly sampling, you would only be within 136% of the true mean. So you can see that that you're paying a big price for collecting only 4 samples a year in terms of your accuracy of your monitoring program. Moving to slide 22, if your monitoring objective is to detect and document a change in water quality due to some intervention, such as application of VMPs or implementation of your watershed plan, your selected sampling frequency should be able to detect the magnitude of the anticipated change against that background noise or natural variability of the system being monitored. And in slide 23, I'll show you a formula for calculating that minimum detectable change. It's not quite as complicated as it might look. Again, the T statistic for a certain number of degrees of freedom is something you look up from a table. N is the number of samples taken in the pre-period, and N post is the number of samples taken in the post-treatment period. MSE stands for mean square error in each period, which is simply the variance divided by the number of samples. And I should point out, in this equation, the number of samples in the pre-period and the post-period do not have to be the same. For the example I'm going to work through, they are, but it doesn't have to be the same. Moving to slide 24, we'll run through an example. Here we know a little bit about the TSS concentration in a river, and we know the standard deviation, and we want to evaluate the minimum detectable change for weekly, monthly, and quarterly sampling for a year before and a year after the implementation of erosion control practices, for example. So clicking over to slide 25, you see the results of these calculations, and I hope, by the way, that you're seeing the same numbers that I'm going to mention. We did update the slides last week, so hopefully you have gotten the most recent version of this slideshow. But the results in slide 25 show that for weekly sampling in this particular river, the minimum detectable change is 14% for total suspended solids. For monthly sampling, that minimum detectable change goes up to 65%. And for quarterly sampling, which is quite common in some watershed projects across the country, that minimum detectable change becomes huge, almost 200%. So going to slide 26, what you can learn from this in this particular case, if you were seeking or expecting a reduction of 25% in a mean annual total suspended solids concentration, if that was the goal in your watershed project, a weekly sampling schedule could, in fact, document that kind of change with some statistical confidence. However, the monthly sampling could not. You would require a 65% or greater change in TSS concentration if you were using a monthly sampling program. And pretty clearly from the example, quarterly sampling for TSS would be ineffective in this particular case. And Steve and I recommend really that when you're evaluating or designing a monitoring program, we recommend that you make this kind of minimum detectable change calculation and evaluate it against your overall project goals. And realistically, if a proposed monitoring program has little or no chance of measuring an anticipated change, for example, quarterly in this example, it might be best to either seek additional resources and redesign your program, or I know this is kind of scandalous sounding, but abandon the monitoring plan altogether so that you're not wasting resources collecting samples that won't show you anything. I'm going to change the move to the next topic, starting on slide 27, and talk about lag time issues in watershed projects. And I know it's really hard to believe, but it is true that some watershed land treatment projects over the decades have reported little or no improvement in water quality after extensive application of management measures in the watershed. And one reason for this, we believe, is lag time. And on slide 28, we can define lag time as the time that elapses between the installation or adoption of land treatment practices and a measurable improvement of water quality in your receiving water. And this lag time will vary by pollutant, by the problem being addressed, and by the water body type. And of course, if lag time is greater than the duration of monitoring, you're quite unlikely to show a clear water quality change. On slide 29, we define three main components of lag time, moving from left to right. First, the time required for a practice or practices to actually produce the desired effect at the edge of a field or the edge of a neighborhood, for example. Next is the time required for that effect to be delivered to the water body of interest. And third is the time required for that water body to actually respond to the effect that's delivered to it and show a change in water quality. Where there's two other components that are often perceived as part of lag time. On the top is the planning and implementation phase, how long it takes to plan and begin a watershed project. And then below, in the bottom portion of the slide, measurement components. For example, how your monitoring program is designed to detect that change, going back to the minimum detectable change exercise that we just went through. And I'd like to go through some examples of some of these components that may ring true for a number of you. Part of the time required for a practice to produce an effect often has to do with development of a BMP, particularly a vegetative BMP. How long, for example, does it take to grow a riparian forested buffer? It may take 10 years. It may take 20 years. That's going to be introduce a significant lag time between treatment and response. A second example of the time required to produce an effect is the actual behavior of the source. If you have an erosion problem, a soil loss problem, erosion control measures will often have a fairly rapid effect on soil loss and sediment delivery to a waterway. Compare that against nutrient management, which is trying to affect a level of soil test phosphorus on an agricultural field. It may take many, many years to actually mine that excessive phosphorus out of the field before you see a change in the behavior of that source. Going to slide 31, talk briefly about the time required for an effect to be delivered through a watershed. The delivery path is an obvious factor. If the pollutant is delivered in surface runoff, can get into a waterway much more quickly, reach the water body in a fairly short period of time compared to a pollutant, perhaps nitrate or a soluble pesticide, that's transported primarily through groundwater, which may move considerably more slowly and take decades rather than weeks to reach a water body. Also, part of this is the nature of the pollutant itself. If you're talking about a dissolved pollutant that tends to move with flowing water down a stream or a river, that may be delivered to the water body considerably more quickly than sediment or a particulate attached pollutant, which can be transported down through the watershed intermittently with large storm events and then temporarily held up in a river system. Slide 32 addresses some examples for the time required for a water body to respond. And again, this goes back to the nature of the impairment. If the water body is impaired by indicator bacteria like E. coli or fecal coliform that tend to die when they get out of the animal's system, the response of a water body may be considerably faster than if the pollutant is a persistent organic chemical that takes decades or longer to degrade. From a biological example, it may be fairly quick to restructure a stream channel reach, but how long will it take fish to come back to that section and reproduce and restore the fishery? A final example of a problem or an issue with water body response, one that I experienced directly, is related to phosphorus in particular. If you cut off the source of phosphorus from the watershed to the water body, but there's internal loading from the aquatic sediments, which have built up a large reservoir of phosphorus, that can introduce a lag time of, again, of decades before you actually see a response in the water body. Moving to slide 33, I'd like to talk briefly about how we deal with lag time, which is an unfortunate fact of life in many, if not all, of our systems. And the first aspect is really emphasizes the importance of characterizing the watershed. Understand how your watershed works, where the pollutant sources are, how they are transported through the system. Know what to expect if the pollutants are moving through groundwater, for example, versus surface runoff. If you're at the point of selecting BMPs to address a problem, consider the lag time in what you select for your treatment. Your lag time in building a fence to keep cows out of a stream is probably going to be considerably shorter than planting trees and waiting for the riparian forested buffer to grow in. And finally, you can, if you have a choice of where to monitor, you are probably going to show change more quickly if you monitor small watersheds close to sources, as opposed to monitoring in a large receiving body such as an estuary or a large lake. And another way to deal with lag time is to use something other than only water quality variables or water quality data to check on your progress. Use social indicators as an intermediate check on progress. Are things moving in the right direction? Are farmers adopting nutrient management plans? Are cities paying more attention to their stormwater? Look at these social indicators to make sure that we're moving in the direction we want to go. And from a purely practical standpoint, for water quality monitoring, it's possible in a long-term water quality monitoring program to interrupt monitoring during the time when BMPs may be installed and require time to grow in, and then start back up monitoring after those BMPs become active. So with that, moving to slide 35 and see a picture of our smiling faces, I think we move into our question and answer period.
Okay, thanks, Don. Thanks, Steve. We'll pause here briefly to take some questions. Let's begin first with those that are submitted online. Just as a reminder, you can submit questions online at any time by clicking on the question mark button at the top of the slides page for those that are displaying by streaming audio. The first question that we've got online, and I'll let Steve take the first crack at this, we heard from William in Media, Pennsylvania, and he asks, he says the Chester Ridley Crum Watersheds Association has a watershed monitoring program that's been going on for about over 10 years. And to date, he said that we've collected the data and a lot of monitoring data and posted on our website. But as an all-volunteer monitoring group, we've not attempted to make any trends assessment of the data. And he asked, so what do you suggest we do with this data? How do we get started?
I'm not exactly sure what you're looking for here as an answer, but one of the first things to do with any data set is to plot the data. If you have 10 years of data, then you ought to put that all in some kind of plot so that you can see what seems to be going on with the data. In terms of doing specific statistical tests on the data, that, you know, you can do some basic statistics on your data, look at it, but to do the statistical tests, there are certain criteria you have to meet in order to perform those tests. And Don is more of a statistician than I am, so Don, if you could add to this, I'd appreciate it.
Sure, Steve. I I think there's a whole set of techniques called exploratory data analysis that, as Steve mentioned, starts with plotting your data. Always look at your data. It'll tell you a lot if you just plot it in a time series, for example. But there's a whole set of procedures for exploratory data analysis, and which we really can't get into now. But that's where I would start. And if you get on Google exploratory data analysis or EDA, you'll probably find some resources out there. I don't mean to be critical of your program, but it just does, I have to say, it does illustrate that a need to look at your data frequently. Your data that you accumulate should be looked at more frequently than after 10 years of accumulating. Anne? Hello?
Oops, hello.
Anne.
Sorry. Hello.
Yes.
Another question for you, sorry. Don, another question for you from Arthur, Austin, Texas. This is a statistically related question. How are statistical analyses used to determine sampling frequencies for event-based monitoring designs?
Oh, that is a good question, one that I don't have a ready answer for, because the material that I covered was really looking for looking at an annual time series in natural systems for long-term mean estimation. I'm afraid I can't give you a specific rule of thumb for that kind of question. Steve, do you have something from the urban sector on developing EMCs might be applicable?
Sorry, Don, we were talking about the next question. What was that again you wanted from me?
Well, I was thinking that you might have something to add to this about computing or estimating the number of samples required during an event. There might be something in the urban stormwater arena related to developing a good EMC or event mean concentration.
I don't have it. One point on the question about the statistics. Looking into that USDA document that Clausen put together on monitoring, there is quite a bit of information on how to analyze the data as well, and I think that's a good starting point for people to use.
Okay, thank you, Steve. I think we've got another question here for Don. This is from Abe in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and he asks, how do you remove autocorrelation from continuous data, e.g. from thermograph data?
That is an excellent question, and that is one of the big problems with continuous data from either a thermograph or a turbidity sensor deployed in a stream. And that kind of data set can be highly subject to serial correlation. The answer in my practice would be to aggregate those data to, there's no hard and fast rule, but I would start with no less than a daily mean, compute a daily mean for your time series, and look at the autocorrelation or the serial correlation. And if it's still significant, then perhaps go to a two-day or even a weekly mean, depending on how long your time series goes.
Okay, thanks, Don. I guess we're going to, at this time, I would like people to unmute your phones. And if anyone would like to ask a question on the phone, please unmute yourself and give your name and organization before your question. Questions, please.
I couldn't tell whether any questions or not.
Yeah, she knows as much about this project. Oh, it is really cool. I really want to.
Questions, we're going to back to our program here. And I'm going to ask everybody to move to slide 36. The Watersheds Academy next webcast will be on May 13th. And this webcast will be from 2 to 4 Eastern Standard Time. This webcast will focus on the issue of wetlands and climate change, which is very apropos as May is American Wetlands Month. So please visit the Watershed Academy webcast page at www.epa.gov, Watershed Webcasts. That's one word. And we will have more information about this webcast posted shortly. So all right, at this time we are going to move back to Steve Dressing, who will continue the discussion of the various monitoring design steps.
Okay, I'm on slide 37 now. We pick up on step 9, designing your stations. And this is also obviously determined largely by the objectives that you have and the monitoring design that you selected, paired up, down, and trend. Three things to keep in mind are redundancy, simplicity, and quality. You want to collect good data reliably, so you need to have a quality installation. You need to keep it simple because the more complicated you get, the more likely you can have issues that you need to deal with. And redundancy is important for things like flow, for example. If that's a key variable that you're monitoring, maybe have more than one way to monitor flow. I know that's a budget issue, but the alternative can be no data. If you're going to monitor stream discharge, which you should be if you're doing loads, you could have several situations. You could maybe use weirs or flumes, or maybe you'll need to monitor that using natural channels. We would recommend that you avoid culverts. That creates some difficulties in estimating the flow. And it's important to recognize that your stage discharge relationship, as I mentioned earlier, will probably change throughout the course of your watershed project, particularly if the practices you're installing are designed to deal with peak flow type issues. If you're monitoring precipitation, and you probably should be in most projects, that can be done in a number of ways and with a number of objectives. You can use it to help you with event sampling, using your precipitation data to help trigger that. You could use it simply to look at, are we having wet years or dry years? And depending upon the kind of data you need, you could either use recording or non-recording rain gauges. It's important to consider the location of your stations. Often people use existing precipitation monitoring setups that are located, frankly, nowhere near the watershed that they're doing their work in. It's important that the precipitation data be representative of the watershed that you're monitoring. Moving to slide 38, if you're monitoring for water chemistry, you could do grab samples, and that's a really easy thing in terms of designing stations. You just pick where you want to go. Passive samplers aren't generally used for watershed type monitoring. You see those used a lot more on field type monitoring. Frequently, people are using, most commonly, automated samplers made by people like ISCO and Sigma. And you can do some pretty sophisticated things with those samplers. You can trigger them to sample based on precipitation or flow or stage. An example that comes to mind is a national monitoring program for 319 in New York, where they had to trigger their sampling on a small dairy site to precipitation, because if they waited for the flow, it would be too late to collect their sample. They'd miss too much. Moving on to site 39, if you're going to sample biology, you have different considerations. You know, open water sampling of plankton, periphyton. Most non-point source projects typically monitor macroinvertebrates and fish, and you need to find locations where that type of sampling can be done and done well. On moving to slide 40, we'll talk briefly about data collection and analysis methods. And when you get into that, you start thinking seriously about, you have a quality assurance project plan. And granted, it's a painful experience, can be, but it's really beneficial. If you do a very good job in a QAP, or equivalent type document, then you've pretty much laid out most of the or all of the information you need to design an effective monitoring program. And you've also laid out the information that can help you develop reliable cost estimates for that program. On slide 41 now, I'll talk a little about land use monitoring. And when you look at a watershed project effectiveness monitoring, you're trying to see if the things you implement on the ground are causing changes in water quality. So we've talked about the water quality side of the equation at length, and this is the other half. This is the land use monitoring. And you need it to make sure that the things are happening on the ground, or if you're doing a paired watershed study in the control watershed where there is not supposed to be any change, you need to make sure that there isn't any change. So it's important to make sure what your plan was is actually happening. And you need it to help interpret your water quality data. It's important when tracking land use land treatment to not just take stuff, you know, like from USDA, acres of this, acres of that, but to think about what is it about this land use or land treatment that relates to the water quality variables I'm monitoring. So you can have a more descriptive tracking of land use land treatment so that you can use that to relate to your water quality data. For example, if the issue is cattle in the stream, rather than just report the feet of fence that have been installed, perhaps track the number of animal hours in the stream, because that's actually what's causing the sediment and the deposition of manure in the stream. But think about that sort of thing when selecting your land use land treatment variables. And the sampling frequency for land use land treatment will depend upon what you're going to do with the data. If you're going to use it with monthly summaries of water quality data, then you need to have some monthly summaries of land use land treatment, which tells you something about how frequently you need to sample or track land use land treatment. Also, some land use activities vary considerably during the course of a year. You need to look at those more frequently than things that are more static. Moving to slide 42, designing data management. Most watershed projects involve information, if you're tracking both land use and water quality, information from a variety of sources. They use different computers and different databases, et cetera. It's important to work out up front what it is that people are going to give you, when they're going to give it to you, in what format, and we would recommend that you have written agreements with your cooperators. Regarding data storage, GIS is a wonderful tool. It has a lot of really great applications, but it's not always needed for watershed projects. What's most important is that whatever software you intend to use, it's something that everyone that's in your team of people providing data and doing analyses can work with that same software. And as a brief promo here, EPA encourages states and monitoring groups to put their data into STORET. STORET is the National Repository for Water Quality Data, and you can see on slide 42 the web's address for STORET. Now, moving to slide 43, reporting. As we've mentioned already, we recommend that you examine your data frequently and report, we would say quarterly. That may not be a requirement, but we think it's something you ought to try to do. By looking at your data, you can identify problems that could become really big problems later. Maybe a probe is fouled, or you know, things are happening in the watershed you didn't anticipate, and it's showing up in your water quality data. It's important to check it so you can catch these things before it's too late. And it's important to keep everyone in your project involved and informed about the data, because frankly, they know things you don't know. And if you give them your information, they might be able to help you interpret it. Now I'll move on to a couple slides quickly to talk about some new things, I think, that are happening in the world of biological monitoring. Slide 44, I worked with Mike Barber of Tetra Tech, is doing some work with EPA, and he provided some of this information. This slide is about what's called the biological condition gradient. And basically, if you look at the y-axis, you see biological condition, and on the x-axis is exposure to stressors, chemical and physical type stressors. And basically, the condition is a function of the stressors. As there's longer more prolonged acute exposure to stressors, biological condition decreases. This is a useful way to look at things in terms of solving watershed problems, but also in terms of coming up with monitoring approaches. And if we move on to slide 45 now, this basically just indicates that biological integrity is related as a function of chemical and physical integrity, that if you have degradation in either the chemical or physical side of the equation, then biological condition will be altered. One of the key things about this relationship, as we move on to slide 46, is try to nail some of the specific links between biological organisms and stressors, so that by collecting biological data, you can have a better chance of interpreting what some of the causes are and what the stressors are, and that in turn helps you design your management plan to control those stressors, and your monitoring then can also track both the biological endpoints and the stressors. Can't get into that too much here, but there are references in the list of additional resources, and one in particular, the Causal Analysis Diagnosis Decision Information System, or CADIS, is an online tool that addresses the stressor identification. And some of the research isn't there today, perhaps, to help you use this directly, but it's something that's being developed that is something to keep an eye on. Now, slide 47, using biological monitoring to measure project effectiveness. When you're doing biological monitoring, it's important to get the whole picture. Like in a previous slide, look at the stressors as well as the biological communities. Are your nutrient levels high, that sort of thing. And track them as well as your biology over the course of the project. So maybe you can see incremental changes rather than big changes in use support using your biological monitoring. When monitoring biological communities and the stressors, it may be that rather than just collect a grab sample with your bug sampling, you might want to check the stressors more frequently, because after all, the macroinvertebrates, for example, are being exposed to those stressors the whole time, yet you may be going out to monitor just once. By looking at it more frequently, you can tell the story better about the important stressors to help you interpret the biological communities. That's it for now. I guess we move into another question session.
Okay, thanks, Steve. We're going to have a little bit of time now for some questions. However, I first want to draw your attention to where you can obtain the contact information for all of our speakers today. If you're online, you can simply click on the home button at the top of your screen. You'll be returned to the seminar's homepage, which has the speaker's email address and phone numbers. So first, let's take some questions that we've received online. One of the questions that we've received is from Paul in Westlake, Ohio. And he asks, can you please expound on stage discharge relationship changes? What changed those? Steve?
Well, I mean, basically the idea there is that as the stage, which is the depth of the water, you have a relationship between the depth and the amount of water passing through, let's say, a natural channel. The idea is that that relationship can change throughout the course of your project by a variety of things that might be happening in the watershed. And it's important to make sure that you know what that relationship is throughout the project so that you can get good estimates on your discharge. Don, you might want to add to this because you've done this, dealt with this issue a lot more than I have.
Yeah. Some of the things that actually will change that are, you know, large storms, which may lead to scour of the stream bed and change the cross-sectional area of the stream. It's, of course, going to change the relationship between water depth and flow. Similarly, deposition will change that relationship. And that's in terms of physically changing that stage discharge relationship. If you're talking about changing the flow regime of a watershed, lots of different management measures will do that effect on water quality, water quantity. I'm not sure that's the question, though, in this case.
Okay, thanks, Don. We've got another question from Judy in Plattsburgh, New York, and she's referring to slide 44, and she's asking, is the relationship here between ecological condition and stressors really linear?
This is Steve. I would say that you need to consider that that particular graphic is a conceptual illustration, and I would bet that it's probably not as linear as that, even if it is, but right now I think just consider that conceptual.
Okay, thanks, Steve. We had another question here, and I guess either you, Don, or Steve could answer this, and the question is from Peter in Milwaukee. He's asking, what are some successful examples of communicating the lag time between BNP investment and water quality improvement to the public that funds the BNP investment? Steve?
Let me see that again. Okay. Yeah, that's a good question about successful examples. I'm not sure that I can put my thumb on many of them, but I will say that there are some projects, for example, the Chesapeake Bay, where the public seems to be quite patient dealing with the lag time. And so it wasn't really addressed so much as a lag time issue, but I think the importance of restoring that water body to the conditions that people wanted to have makes people more willing to be patient. But I don't think this was an explicit communication of lag time.
Well, if I could jump in here, Ann, the Chesapeake actually I think has done better than many projects at being fairly explicit about the lag times that they expect, and they have actually published estimates of how long they believe it will take to come to equilibrium in nitrate concentrations, for example, based on elimination of nitrogen fertilizers. I'm not sure how successful they have been in communicating that or getting stakeholders to go along with that, but they've been fairly out front about it.
Okay. Thanks, Don. Another question, I think this may be for you, Don, of Gary from Kingston, New York. There's a question about statistics. For the statistics that you use to estimate sample size, was the distribution considered, he asks. The t-test specifically requires that the data are from a normal distribution.
Yes, that's a good question, and if this had been an intensive statistical discussion, I would have started out with saying that we are assuming, since the T statistic comes from parametric statistics, you have to meet the assumptions of normality of distribution, independence of observation, and consistency of variance. And so, yes, you would have to think about the distribution. And by the way, for you statistics fans out there, the T that you use in those two examples I gave is a two-tailed T, not a one-tailed T.
Okay, thanks, Dan. At this point, I'm going to ask anybody if they want to ask a question to unmute your phone and ask Steve or Dan a question. Please give your name and organization before your question. Any questions?
This is Brad in Region 6.
Okay.
I have a question regarding, well, it's a response to slides 28 and 33 regarding the lag time. And I note that in the discussion, it wasn't noted that the location of the BMPs within that watershed or proximity to the stream was not considered as an issue that would affect lag time as well. And I would assume that I guess you could assume that if you characterize a watershed and you design your watershed plan, I mean your quality assurance project plan on monitoring, assuming where BMPs are going to be placed, then I guess the voluntary concept of getting those BMPs in place would certainly play into this. So proximity to the stream and location of BMPs could have an effect on lag time, right?
Yes, you're absolutely correct. In the interest of brevity of this presentation, I did reduce the number of parameters that I talked about as examples in each case, and location in the watershed is one that got left out, but you're absolutely correct.
Somewhere downstream.
Hi, thanks for the question. Any other questions?
Hard to have one. Mm-hmm. There, one or two would be fine.
At least monitor your conversation. Okay, it looks like there are no further questions at this point. I'm going to ask Don for you to proceed with the presentation on slide 49.
Okay. Going to address the topic of pollutant loads, or estimating pollutant loads, because many of our monitoring programs are designed or intended to assess changes in pollutant loads, it's important to talk about how we actually go about estimating a load from a set of monitoring data. And I'm on slide 49, by the way. Load is simply the flux or the mass of a pollutant that's transported over a time period. And if you could actually put a probe out in the stream and measure pollutant flux directly and get a graph such as one shown in slide 49 and integrate the area under that green line, you'd have a perfect measure of load. Unfortunately, reality doesn't allow that. Going to slide 50, we can't measure flux directly, at least not yet. So we typically have to calculate load as a product of concentration and flow. And because we almost always have to measure, and to back up, that first equation is a mathematical way of showing that the load is the integral of concentration times flow over time. But because we almost always have to measure concentration in a series of discrete samples or discrete observations, even if it's with a probe, you know, every 15 seconds or 15 minutes or something, you're still making a set of discrete measurements in time, the actual estimation of load becomes a sum of a set of products between flow and concentration, as shown in the lower box there, the summation of concentration times flow over time. And it's making the choices of exactly how to do this that makes load estimation pretty challenging. Moving to slide 51, some examples. Because we're dealing with non-point sources predominantly, the greatest flux tends to occur during a relatively few high-flow periods over the course of a year. When and how often to sample is of critical importance going into a load estimation. And this set of graphs, the green shaded area represents the so-called true load based on daily samples in a large river system. And this is actual data from Ohio plotted in these panels. If you look at the top panel, the red line represents a plot of flux based on weekly samples, taking it one sample a week over the course of the year, and you can see that it does a pretty good job of matching that line. Those samples on the red line hit most, if not all, of the peaks. The red line on the bottom panel is a plot of the flux based on monthly samples, and you can see that a number of these important peaks would be missed by that. And then again on the bottom panel, that black line represents quarterly samples, and I hope you can see pretty clearly that that kind of a quarterly sampling program would essentially miss all of the important flux events over a year and give us a serious underestimate of load. Going to slide 52, some of the things in terms of practical load estimation, some of the things you have to think about. Sample type, Steve talked about, but grab samples versus fixed interval samples, whether collected by hand or by an automatic sampler, versus flow proportional samples, that's a kind of a decision you have to make. Sampling frequency, I talked about this earlier, but in general the accuracy and the precision of a load estimate is going to increase as sampling frequency increases. And sample timing is a more complex topic to deal with than straightforward frequency, and it is highly dependent on your system. You really need to consider the sources of variability in your system. If you live in a region like I do where we have pronounced seasons, we just experienced probably 75% of our annual flux from our major tributaries into Lake Champlain with spring runoff. If you're in an agricultural watershed, the season of animal waste application or tillage might be where all the action is. So you have to consider timing as well as frequency. Going to slide 53, you need to choose a sampling regime that gives you the best picture of the concentration component of the load estimation question or equation. Sample type, I mentioned, fixed interval sampling is very common, go out every Tuesday or go out every other week. A fixed interval sampling program is typically biased toward low flows and will generally underestimate concentrations over the course of a year. You have another choice of going to a stratified sampling type where you focus more attention on when the action is, take more samples during high flow periods than during base flow. Again, that's going to be specific to your geographical area. And flow proportional sampling, which was mentioned earlier, where you take the number of samples directly proportional to the flow in the river or the stream. That's an ideal. It's quite difficult to do in practice, but it does give the most precise answer about concentration. Frequency, it's hard to really come up with a hard and fast rule, but a rule of thumb, at least in flowing surface waters, would be on the order of 20 to 100 samples a year, but you should always consider the concept of minimum detectable change in coming up with that number, and that's really a crude rule of thumb. And again, timing, as I mentioned, stratification of your sampling effort toward the most important season, the most critical source activity, or the most high loading flow conditions would be quite important. Moving to slide 54, I want to really briefly touch on, although I won't explain probably enough of because of the time limitations, specific approaches to making load calculations. The first is numeric integration, which isn't as scary as that equation might look. It's simply summing up a series of flow times concentration results based on the data that you have. If you have monthly concentration data, you assume that each sample represents your monthly concentration, multiply it times the monthly flow, and that's your monthly load. That tends to be quite prone to error if your concentration measurements are infrequent. And the example I just used of monthly sampling would probably be much too prone to error to be a really good load estimate. Another approach is generally termed, there's a number of variations of this, but generally termed regression approaches where you use a documented relationship between flow and concentration in your system, not from a textbook, but in your system, to use that relationship to estimate concentration when you're not actually measuring concentration. So in other words, you use that regression between flow and concentration to estimate concentration for those 29 days of the month where you didn't actually take a sample, would be one approach. And then a third general area is called a ratio estimator, where you would adjust the estimated daily load by some ratio of observed flow to a mean flow in the system. And I won't really say anything more mathematically about those. There are resources out there to calculate these with computer programs and that sort of thing. But I want to move to slide 55 and show some examples of the results of different approaches. And again, these are real data, data from intensively monitored river system in Ohio. And as before, that green bar on slide 55 represents the best estimate of the true load based on daily samples, much more intensive than most of us could afford to measure. the bar number two, moving from left to right, bar number two is an estimate based on something called the Beal ratio estimator using daily data, and you can see that that's nearly identical to the so-called true suspended sediment load in that system, so it's quite a good approach in that particular case. Bar number three is a simple regression approach, which is pretty poor. It estimates the load at about 1,000 versus a real load of almost 2,500. So it's a pretty poor estimate, but breaking that regression down into two seasonal regressions, as shown in the bar label number four, improves it, and that's because of the seasonality in the system where these data were collected, a strong spring runoff component compared to a summer baseflow. Moving a little farther to the right, the person who put this slide together took subsamples of his data set to represent a weekly sampling period based on collecting a sample every Sunday. And bar number five is a Beal ratio estimator estimate of load using that weekly data. And number six is weekly data using the regression approach. And you can see there's a difference there, and it's a somewhat of an underestimate of the true load. The last two bars, bars number seven and eight, on the right, represent the same approach, only taking samples from data from samples taken every Friday as opposed to every Sunday, and those estimates are very far off. And it turned out in this particular data set that the annual load was dominated strongly by a few storms during the year, and those storms all happen on weekends. As anybody who has to go out and take samples knows, that the big storms always happen on weekends, and for that reason, Friday samples seem to underestimate the load in this case. So moving to slide 56, what can we learn from thinking about how to estimate loads? Some of the questions before you embark on a monitoring program to determine load or that's going to depend on load estimation, we think you need to ask yourself a series of questions. And the first is a load estimate really necessary, or can you meet project goals by using concentration data alone? If the answer is that you can do it with concentration data alone, generally speaking, for the same dollar, you can do a much better job getting concentration data than going the next step and getting load data. The second thing you need to consider is to think about or determine the precision needed in your load estimates. Don't try to document the response to a BMP program that you think might be a 25% load reduction with a monitoring program that can only measure load estimates within plus or minus 50% of the true load. You're pretty much doomed to failure there. Third, you need to decide what approach you'll use to calculate loads, hopefully before the fact, before you put your monitoring program in place, based on either known or expected attributes of the data, how variable the data are, for example. And then use those precision goals to calculate the sampling frequency and figure out the timing requirements for your monitoring program. And finally, as you go along, compare your ongoing load estimates with program goals and see if you're doing enough of a, if you're doing well enough to meet your goals, or do you have to adjust your sampling program to suit it better. Finally, on this topic, slide 57, I hope I've conveyed that load estimation is by no means a trivial task that you can do as an afterthought. Generally speaking, quarterly or even monthly concentration data are pretty unlikely to be adequate for good load estimates. And the third important lesson, I think, is to emphasize high flow events and important seasons when most of the action is. And if load data are necessary for your program, you really need to design the monitoring program with load estimation in mind before you even take the first sample or collect the first piece of data. Very little can be done after the fact to compensate for a data set that contains too few observations or were collected with an inappropriate sampling design. I want to move on to the next section on slide 58, I want to talk about, give a few examples of successful watershed monitoring programs. These are from the US EPA Section 319 National Non-Point Source Monitoring Program. And, of course, I have to use my own project as an example. As the first example, the Vermont project we conducted from 1993 through 2001. Our goal was to evaluate the effectiveness of livestock exclusion, stream bank protection, and riparian restoration to address problems of nutrients, sediment, and indicator bacteria from agricultural land, specifically dairy pasture land, to surface waters. And we implemented fencing and other low-tech practices to keep cows out of the stream, and we wanted to document changes in concentrations and loads of phosphorus, nitrogen, sediment, and bacteria at the watershed outlets. We also evaluated the response of stream biota. On slide 60, a little thumbnail sketch of our monitoring program. It was conducted by a paired watershed design. We did have two treatment watersheds, the shaded watersheds in the map, and then a control watershed at the top of that map. We monitored discharge continuously, had flow proportional automated composite sampling, which resulted in a weekly composite sample for analysis. Twice a week, we collected grab samples for bacteria and temperature conductance and dissolved oxygen. We monitored the invertebrates, habitat, and fish annually. And we conducted an annual land use and land management survey and data collection effort. Changing over to slide 61, just quick some results. We did see significant reductions in pollutant concentrations and load. We saw improvements in the invertebrate community to the point where one of our streams did meet our state biocriteria. We did not see significant change in the fish community, which may be a lag time issue. We didn't stick around long enough to make that determination. On slide 62, I'd like to go to a little farther west in the country to talk about a Lake Pittsfield, Illinois project. The goal of this project was to reduce sediment loads from agricultural land primarily into a water supply reservoir that had experienced a serious loss of capacity due to sedimentation. You can see on the map on the left, the dark blue areas were areas that had filled in since the reservoir was created in 1962. And the BMPs that were implemented were primarily sediment retention basins at first. This project used a before, after, and a trend design, conducted automated storm event monitoring at several watershed stations for flow and TSS, monitored lake water quality, and kept track of stream bank erosions by conducting channel cross-section surveys. An important part of this project was that interim monitoring results were looked at carefully and were used to target sub-watersheds for specific treatment and to design additional treatments to compensate for the reduced sediment concentration in the stream as the project went along. And we'll probably mention this project more a little bit later. On slide 64, you can see the results of this project were about a 45% reduction in sediment yields in this watershed. And you can see this by looking at after 1998 on this graph. You can see that the sediment yield plotted as per unit discharge plotted in the green and the light blue lines dropped substantially, as did the absolute sediment yields after 1998. As a final example on slide 65, moving farther west to Oregon, this was a fish-focused project, the goal of which was to improve the salmonid community through restoring habitat and stream temperatures in a stream that had been heavily impacted by grazing and logging. And the overall objective was to document the effectiveness of these channel restorations on water temperature and the fish community. On slide 66, a map of their monitoring regime. They used a before and after channel restoration design and as well looked at a control reach in a nearby stream. They conducted continuous air and water temperature monitoring, periodic habitat assessments, and monitored fish by snorkel surveys, which I have never seen, but I imagine that it looks like people hanging around in these streams with snorkels and wetsuits looking at fish. On slide 67, there's a plot of some of the results from this project. They did find cooler water temperatures in pools and deeper runs after the restoration. They documented reduced width depth ratios in restored reaches. And most importantly, the rainbow trout numbers increased after restoration in the restored reaches while they were constant or actually decreased in unrestored and control reaches. So that was pretty convincing evidence of success of the project. And I believe that takes us to slide 68 and our next question and answer period.
Okay, thanks, Don. Yes, we will again have some time for questions. First, let's take some of the questions that we have received online. Amber from Boise, Montana asks a question, I think, for you, Don, about, she says that phosphorus is tightly bound to sediment, and it has been said that continuous input of phosphorus is necessary to maintain excessive algae growth productivity. In your discussion, you suggested a lag time in nutrient response due to recycling of phosphorus from sediment. Can you further explain that?
Certainly. As the questioner points out, the phosphorus is bound to the sediment, and in a classic case when that sediment is introduced to a lake and deposited at the bottom, that sediment, because of oxygen relationships and redox potential, the phosphorus was thought to be locked away in aquatic sediments. In the case that I spoke of in St. Albans Bay and Lake Champlain, there's actually a shallow bay that had been receiving highly enriched phosphorus runoff from tributaries for decades, and the sediments were quite enriched with phosphorus. And when we conducted our project for the Rural Clean Water Program, we monitored substantial implementation of dairy management practices in the watershed, but saw no change in phosphorus concentrations in the bay. And some sediment work did document that phosphorus was being released from these sediments that were highly enriched. Part of that was through turbulence and stirring up of the sediments because it's a fairly shallow bay. Since then, there have been several investigations that have actually looked at that potential, and the bay continues to this day to have water quality problems, primarily due to the phosphorus coming out of the sediments.
Okay, thanks, Don. A quick question that we had from Laura in Salina, Ohio. She's asking, which river were you referring to in Ohio? And she says, it's okay if you don't want to say.
I don't have a problem saying. In fact, I should attribute the authorship of that data set as by Dr. Peter Richards from Heidelberg College, and I believe that that's from the Sandusky River, although I could be wrong on that. Steve, do you recall?
I think that's right, the Sandusky River.
Okay, thanks, guys. Don, another question for you. This is from Judy in Plattsburgh, New York, and she says, for the fencing project that you talked about to keep the cows out, how many cows actually were in the stream, and how much was, I guess, the manure reduced to get your results? Can you do a per-cow increment of improvement calculation? Now, that's a new one.
Well, those are good questions, I didn't have enough, I'll be honest and admit I did not have enough resources to actually go out there and count cow hours as Steve proposed in his talk earlier. The metrics that I used to try to relate that level of treatment to water quality were more related to the percentage of the watershed cows that were grazing in pastures that were protected, or the length of protected stream in each watershed. And I didn't really have enough replicates to express that on water quality improvements on a per cow or per foot basis. I can say that I, based on other evidence, I think that the water quality improvement came primarily from fencing the cows out and keeping that manure deposition and attack on the stream banks from happening, as opposed to any filtration of a vegetated riparian zone, because the effect was fairly quick. There was very little lag time between putting up the fence and being able to see changes in water quality.
Okay, thanks, Dan. Often there are resource issues. At this time, I'm going to ask, if anyone wants to ask Don or Steve a question of the phone, to please unmute yourself and give your name and organization. Any questions?
Oh, I thought you said there was 72
cells. I don't remember.
Hi, Ann. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
This is Deborah Gutenson. I'm actually with the Source Water, Drinking Water Source Protection Program here at EPA. And, Don, going back to your second example, it looked like it was a drinking water reservoir. And I'm wondering if you could, if it would be possible to sort of take the next step and looking at the changes in sediment loading and then tracking that with changes in drinking water treatment cost reductions.
Yeah, that's an excellent proposal, and I'm not sure if the folks in Illinois did that or not. I know that around the country there have been results along that line. There was a national monitoring program project in North Carolina that was able to document substantially reduced costs around a drinking water intake because of erosion control up in the watershed, and that's the Long Creek project in North Carolina. I know in another project of mine up here in the Bay of Lake Champlain, or watershed contributing to Lake Champlain, I could, no matter how I tortured my watershed data, I could not document a significant reduction in suspended sediment or turbidity, but the water utility that was taking water from that bay swears to this day that their raw water turbidity declined as a result of our project. So mm-hmm. I'll take that kind of success where I can get it.
Right. 75, so that's the data. 275.
Okay, thanks.
Please put your phone on mute if you're not speaking.
Okay, we're going to now move back to our presentation, back to slide 69. Don, take it away.
Okay. Again, as Ann said, we're on slide 69, and some of the questions we've had have already talked about issues and problems that people have faced in watershed monitoring, and so we thought we would have a section addressing some common issues that watershed monitoring efforts face and how one might deal with it. And the first and probably most common issue on slide 70 is weather. As anybody who's worked in non-point source knows, the best way to cause a drought or a flood, depending on where you are, is to start a non-point source monitoring project. In, as I've alluded to in several cases, in non-point source work, a large part of the variance in pollutant concentrations results from variance in the weather due to precipitation, amount and distribution, and flow, amount and distribution. So to deal with this weather, the first thing, and it seems obvious but is not always so, is that you have to measure this in order to account for the influence. So you have to actually document the relationship between a weather-related variable and a pollutant concentration. And the example shown in slide 70 is a regression relationship between flow and suspended sediment that at least something seems to be going on there with regard to higher suspended sediments concentrations being seen at higher flows. So how do you deal with it once you've documented and know it's a problem? Slide 71, a couple of approaches. First of all, on the left, going back to the Lake Pittsfield, Illinois project, simply showing, plotting the data can give you an idea that your results may be valid irrespective of weather. And if you look at that plot to the right of 1998, the green and the turquoise lines represent an average sediment concentration in the tributaries, whereas the red and blue lines represent discharge. So you can see, you can appreciate in general, the suspended sediment concentration was low after 1998, even though the stream flow was higher than it had been in the pre-treatment phase. So that gives you a suggestion that your change is not simply because of the weather. Another approach shown on the right is to normalize your data, which in a simple case can be as simple as dividing a concentration by the stream flow at the time that the sample was collected. The U.S. Geological Survey has a little bit more sophisticated approaches to that, where you adjust the flow by the mean or the median for the period and then calculate an adjusted concentration from the adjusted flow using a regression model. I won't say any more about that because it's too much to go into here, but it's something you can find on the web and perhaps use. On slide 72, for the in a more statistical approach, you can use a regression between your concentration variable and flow and conduct your subsequent analysis on the residuals from that regression, which has the influence of flow removed. And a lot of trend analysis is done in this way. And on the plot on the right, the upper panel shows the raw data concentration of dissolved solids in South Dakota, as a matter of fact, and the bottom panel shows the flow-adjusted dissolved solids with the residuals from a regression between flow and dissolved solids. Slide 73, probably the most the strongest way of controlling for weather in non-point source watershed projects is the use of the paired watershed technique, and used properly, both the control and the study watersheds receive the same weather input, and the use of techniques such as analysis of covariance using the data from the control watershed as the covariate will control for the effects of year-to-year weather variation and allow you to conclude that a significant difference is not because of the weather, but because of something else. Another problem in many watersheds on slide 74 is land use change, especially in large watersheds or very long-term watershed projects. Changes in land use, land cover, or land management can very strongly influence water quality. And just like the weather, you have to monitor those variables in order to account for the influence. You have to know what's going on out there, so you have to get out there and find out what's going on. And this applies not just to the land treatment that your watershed plan is actually implementing. It also applies to other changes that are happening in the watershed irrespective of your project, and that can include management of roads and ditches that can have a great effect on pollutant generation and delivery, construction of subdivisions, changes in agriculture that occur over time. And we're not really devoting a lot of time here to talk about how to collect that kind of information, but things like direct observation, driving around the watershed, aerial photography, talking with landowners and other stakeholders in the watershed, and collecting data from public agencies that are active in the area are several ways that can be used to get a handle on what's going on in land use change. Slide 75 shows another approach that you can use to incorporate, to deal with effects of land use change, and that is to incorporate indicator variables. And one of the questions previously talked about, you know, cow hours as an indicator variable, and that's a good example. Here's you could also use acres of conservation tillage, as was used in a Michigan project. Changes in row crop land cover, changes in impervious cover in an urban watershed, changes in fertilizer application or sales. The graph here on the left is from a project in Iowa in Walnut Creek that was restoring native prairie, converting row crop land to native prairie, and they were able to construct a reasonably strong relationship between the change in row crop land cover by percentage with the concentration of nitrate in the stream. And a significant relationship between row crop versus prairie and nitrate concentration. So you can get a handle on the effect of land use change in that kind of approach. Moving to slide 76, there's always the unexpected. Surprises are going to occur. They're going to occur when you don't expect them. That's why they're unexpected. And there's some examples here of projects that their general expectations versus the reality that they found. In Wisconsin, for example, White Clay Lake, the expectations were that they could solve the problem in the lake by addressing phosphorus issues in runoff. The reality that they learned, I think, too late was that only a third or so of the inflow to the lake came from surface water. The rest came from groundwater or direct precipitation. In New York State, Cannonsville Reservoir, part of the New York City Watersheds program, but this was long before then, expected or thought that their major pollution source, phosphorus source, was barnyards, and that their approach, their expectation was if they could manage the barnyards, they would reduce the phosphorus loads to the reservoir. It turned out that through their monitoring, they learned that winter manure spreading was the main source of phosphorus. And I already mentioned the example in my part of the world, St. Albans Bay and Lake Champlain. We expected that we could manage dairy manure on the landscape to help restore water quality, and we learned that the reality was the phosphorus already in the bay sediments were what was really driving the eutrophication problem in the bay. In an Arizona project, there was an expectation that improvements in recreation management at a popular swimming site would be key to controlling the indicator bacteria problems that existed there, and it turned out that the main source of the bacteria were actually from elsewhere in the watershed. And finally, the Lake Pittsfield example, the expectation was that if they could intercept the cropland erosion, they could reduce suspended sediment load to the reservoir, and what they learned, fortunately in mid-project, was that stream channel instability was also a significant source of suspended sediment. So how do you deal with the unexpected? It's pretty difficult. It does underline the importance on slide 77 of good watershed characterization and that problem definition step that Steve mentioned at the very beginning. Understand how your watershed works and the nature of the problem goes a long way to dealing with or avoiding being surprised by things after the fact. Frequent examination and evaluation of your monitoring data. Don't wait 10 years to look at your data set. Look at it quarterly or semi-annually or annually, but look at it often enough so that you know what's going on. Develop feedback loops between the monitoring and the project management so that the people responsible for managing the project overall gain that knowledge of what's being revealed in the monitoring data. And the name of that game is also adaptive management. And returning on slide 78, returning to Lake Pittsfield one last time, the monitoring during the project revealed that channel instability was a larger problem than initially thought, especially since a lot of field erosion had been controlled before it reached the stream. They added stream restoration to their implementation program, and through that addition, we're able to accomplish a 90% reduction in sediment load to the lake. And that's a good example of adaptive management. And with that, I think I turn this back over to Steve for slide 79. We talk about some cost issues.
Yes, we're gonna switch gears now and look at some cost issues, as Don said. This is a real short presentation of some information we developed for a workshop where we got quite involved in looking at alternative costs for different monitoring scenarios with and without volunteers and for various objectives. But basically, this slide 79 just lays out the types of costs that we include in what you'll be seeing in the next few slides. I think it's important to point out that the bottom two items. Oftentimes it seems that the projects run out of money just in time for the final report. And we recommend that whenever projects budget for monitoring that they take seriously the end part of the project as much as they do the beginning of the project. And that, again, I think is where developing a good CLAP can actually be quite beneficial. Moving to slide 80, this is a real rough summary of many scenarios that we ran. You see in the leftmost column, we looked at some basic monitoring designs that, you know, the first one, bugs, habitat, E. coli, and fish. That's the type of thing that often you'll see volunteer monitoring groups can and will do those types of monitoring. Below that is grab chemical, which can be done by, you know, volunteers or professionals alike. And then below that, automated, you know, high-end type monitoring, which generally isn't something that volunteer groups have been able to afford. If you look then across from basic monitoring design, you'll see volunteers only, experts only, and volunteers and experts. Volunteers only is what our cost estimates would be for, you know, just volunteers doing it using volunteer methods. The next column would be experts using usually more high-end methods. And the last column would be some combination where volunteers would work with experts providing labor, and sometimes volunteers would be applying more sophisticated methods to the sampling and data analysis to get higher quality results. And looking at these, you can see you could get a variety of numbers depending upon the assumptions you make on salaries and that sort of thing. But we use real cost information on variables, equipment, travel, things like that. So we think that they're at least in a comparative sense useful to look at. And for volunteers doing the bugs habitat type stuff, you know, the estimate is like $200 to $400 per site per year. If you have experts do it, it goes up quite a bit, $1,200 to $3,000. Some combination could bring it down closer to what it costs for volunteers to do. And this is the kind of thing that you might want to consider in your state and local monitoring programs, is how to best cooperate to get the most draw upon the abilities of others and take advantage of what they can offer, and then, you know, fill in the gaps of what you need to do to try to bring costs down to do the most effective monitoring you can do. If you look at GRAB chemical monitoring, it's in the same ballpark really as the bugs habitat and E. coli monitoring. It's higher, but by order of magnitude is about the same. However, when you get into automated monitoring, you can see the costs go way up. This is the kind of thing you need to know when you're doing load estimation. It's costly, but we assume, I think, in these that the equipment is new equipment that's purchased. Now, if you have existing equipment, some of these costs can be brought down, but you're still generating a lot of samples, and you're having people go out frequently to retrieve the samples. One thing that on the bottom, you can see that all the scenarios that we did, again, this, you know, depending on the labor charges you assume, salary costs, you know, 30 to 80% of total costs. And so that alone points to one way in which volunteers can be quite helpful. So now moving to 81, just some simple rules of thumb when putting together your monitoring plan and budget is that budget needs to be something for your specific monitoring plan, not something that you say, oh, well, we'll do this, we'll do that, and here's the cost. You can get to a specific monitoring budget by going through the CLAP and, you know, laying out all those details. It is a good driver for coming up with a reasonable budget. And that budget should include beginning to ending, including the final reporting. Point that we'd like to make is if you're collecting data, all too often it seems like variables are being monitored or monitored at frequencies that aren't really necessary to the project because there's no plan to use that data. And if that's the case, then that data shouldn't be obtained at any cost and should be dropped. Purchasing the right equipment, some of the things that can be done using low-end kits and that won't provide the type of resolution you need to see the types of changes that you can expect in your watershed. So it's important to make sure, and again, this again gets back to the CLAP, the right methods to get to be able to detect the types of changes you'll see in your watershed, monitor the right variables, and using the right equipment and the right methods. Slide 82, just kind of general wrap-up of some of the things that we've been talking about today. I believe that following the 12 design steps that we laid out in the beginning can be helpful, very helpful in designing your monitoring plan and also doing that within the constraints that you see in your project. And as long as the focus is kept on the monitoring objectives, you can, as long as you can still achieve them, make adjustments to your plan, to deal with some of these constraints, either just physical constraints in the watershed or budget constraints. But most importantly, do what you can do, but make sure that it's done well. Otherwise, the whole thing is a waste. We recommend it again that for watershed project effectiveness that you do paired watersheds, upstream, downstream, or trend designs. And that's a call you'd have to make based on the situation in your watershed. And just one more time, the set of variables that's monitored should be tightly focused. You should have a use for every data element, every data point that you gather in your project. If you don't have a use for it, it's something you don't need to do. So with that, I guess we open up to more questions.
Okay, thanks, Steve and Don. We do have a little time for a few more questions, but first I want you to please move to slide 84, and we're going to ask you to please take a few minutes and submit feedback to us on the webcast, and please do check out the links for additional resources. Steve and Don provided a very extensive list of additional resources, so I think you'll find that helpful. For those of you that are participating online, please look at the left-hand sidebar, and there's a links button which has additional resources identified. Also on the left-hand sidebar, you should see a feedback button. So please take a quick minute or so to submit the online feedback, as we really do value your comments as we strive to improve these webcasts. We do have a few questions that we have received online. First for you, Steve, what in slide 64, what are the WSCOBS? What does that mean? That's David from Rock Island.
Great job. Keep up the good work.
The WASCOBs are water and sediment control basins, and in that particular project, one of the implementation stages involves some really large dams, basically, that they put into the tributaries to that lake.
Okay, thanks, Steve. And Don, we have a question for you. In your Vermont project, what percent of the land in the BMP watersheds was affected by your livestock exclusion and related activities to detect the level of changes that you saw over 8 years? They also asked, were all practices implemented simultaneously?
Okay, answer that second question first as I thumb through, reach over and get my final report, which just happens to be on my shelf. All practices were implemented in one summer field season, but basically between May and September of a particular year, and that defined our pre and post period. I'm trying to look up now the as I said, one of the metrics we used was we used a number of different metrics. Basically, we treated in each of the two treatment watersheds, we treated anywhere between 30% and 50% of the length of stream that passed through pasture land. So of all the candidate stream length, we treated from 30% to 50% of it. In one of the watersheds, we actually treated 96 to 97% of the livestock that were grazing ended up grazing on treated pasture. That percentage was lower in the second watershed, and the pasture area draining to treated streams was roughly in the 30 to 40% range.
Okay, thanks, Don. One other question for you. Why shouldn't you measure stage discharge in culverts?
Very good question. In a perfect world, if the culverts were perfectly installed and perfectly maintained, the culverts might be quite a good place to try to measure discharge. In reality, culverts are plagued by either bad or degraded installations where their slope is in some cases backwards, or submerged outlets are the absolute worst. I know, I'll give you an example. Steve and I have been recently involved in a project in California where some flow monitoring was completely disabled by the fact that a culvert outlet was submerged and rendered any flow data collected at that site invalid, and the station had to be moved. So it's primarily with regard to the hydraulic behavior of the water flowing through the culvert. Specifically, a submerged outlet is the worst. Hello?
Okay, I'm sorry. I have a question here for Steve. On the estimated cost, how often is monitoring being done? Every day, monthly, or quarterly? This is from Karen in Oklahoma.
Well, actually, and this is on slide 80, we looked at a range of frequencies. That's part of the reason there's a range of costs. But in general, for the bugs, habitat, E. coli, and fish, the bugs and habitat, I believe that it'd be one time a year. We may have done it twice a year. For the E. coli, we did that a few different scenarios based on what was needed for use support for swimming. So we looked, I think, 5, 10, and 20 times just to look at how that would vary, change the cost. For grab chemical, I think we looked at weekly for that. And for the automated, we looked at weekly composites.
Okay, thanks, Steve. We've got another question from Karen, another Karen in Ellicott City, and she's asking for clarification also about the costs. Are the cost estimates for the sample collection only, or do they include the analytical costs?
The cost estimates actually include everything that's in slide 79, and that includes laboratory analysis. It includes some estimate of how long it would take to analyze the data, who would do it, what their salary would be. You know, how long it would take to develop the reports, print them, the whole work. So it was intended to be a total cost of doing the monitoring, the analysis of the samples, the analysis, and the reporting.
Okay, good. Thank you. Another question, Steve, for you. This is from Karen, another Karen in Oklahoma. How do you use a grant for a specific monitoring plan when there's a push to develop generic QAPs?
Well, that's more of a policy question. I'm not going to answer that one. But the focus on the QAP here is, you know, call it something else. But the point of it is that a QAP is a very good vehicle for helping you design your monitoring plan so that it meets your data quality objectives, your needs, and if you incorporate things like the minimum detectable change calculations, then you will be in a good place to have a good monitoring design. And I'd recommend you do something like a QAP specific to your plan, even if you're not required to, because you do want to succeed, and a QAP is a good way to get to that endpoint.
Okay, thanks, Steve. At this point, I'm going to unmute phone lines and ask if there are any questions for Don or Steve.
Any questions?
Great job. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Be back. Any other questions? Okay, if not, this concludes today's Watershed Academy webcast.
On behalf of the entire EPA Watershed Academy webcast team, I'd like to thank Steve Gressing, Don Mills, for their help with this webcast. And, of course, thanks to every one of you who joined us. This is Ann Weinberg from EPA's Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds signing off. Have a great day, everyone.